Can't wait.
All right. Let's wait for her to close the door. Well, good morning. My name is Tarek. I'm an addict. A power greater than myself separated me from crack cocaine on the morning November 5th, 2007. And I will be eternally grateful for a loving and powerful God in my life and the fellowship and a group of men and women that I've surrounded myself with that hold me accountable. True, deep, meaningful accountability. Which is part of what these two steps are really about. It's interesting, though, when this morning's workshop, we're going to focus on steps 10 and 11, but there's two versions of practicing 10 and 11. There's the version of having completed all your amends, and there's the version of trying to practice 10 and 11 when you haven't completed all your amends, and they are night and day. And so at the center, I run a center in Atlanta. And I've noticed over the years, you go to the meetings and people, a lot of people will say 10, 11, and 12. Stay in 10, 11, and 12. Those are your maintenance steps. Some people call them the growth steps, but there's always focus on 10, 11, and 12. So in our hub at the center, when a guy transitions, we don't say 10, 11, and 12. We say 9, 10, 11, and 12. Because the focus has to be on step 9. When you get to step 10 on page 84, it says this thought brings us to step 10. And what they've been talking about from page, I think, 76 up until 83 is making amends. And then Thursday night, I referred to the ninth step as the ultimate surrender. And it truly is. It took me 8.5 years to approach roughly 230 people in institutions. There's not a person I'm consciously aware of on this planet that I have not tried to approach to make an amends to that I was on my list. Now, that list didn't start off at 230. It started off probably around 125, 150. But as I stayed clean and sober, I would sit in meetings. I would listen to people share, and they were telling an amends story. And I'm like, oh, no, I've got another one to make. And I kept adding to my list. And, it's the stories that I mean, I can spend an entire day sharing immense stories with all of you. One of the most profound, and the reason I want to do a little bit of a focus on the ninth step to maybe begin your investigation for yourself of the connection between step 9 and step 10 and 11. And so one of the most powerful amends I made, I walked in on my girlfriend cheating on me. I caught her in the act. This was back in 2000. And I got violent, and to her and him, and verbally, physically. And when I got clean and sober, of course, they were both on my amends list. Because after that happened, I really tried to do some damage to his reputation, and I assassinated his character, and I had people turn their backs on him, and all kinds of stuff. When I got clean and sober, of course, she showed up on my amends list. The men that took me through this process, I had to make amends to every ex-girlfriend, which were some of the most powerful amends that I've ever made. Because when you look in someone's eyes, when you sit across the table from them and they tell you how your grosser handicaps have destroyed them to certain degrees, there's something that happens in the remission. Like character defects, I don't think get removed. I think they go into remission, because we all know we can have a defect go into remission and then all of a sudden 3 years later it comes back.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think they get removed, but they do go into remission. And there's something in that process of looking into someone's eyes and seeing that pain. A very dear friend of mine says that the miracle of steps 6 and 7 happens in the actions of 8 and 9. And so I made amends to her, but when I got sober, I had to make 4 lists. The list I would do right now, the list I would do later, the list I might do, and the list I would never do. This man went on my never list. And it was almost 4 years into recovery when I became willing to make an amends to him. But it wasn't one of those ones that was planned out. I was a salesman for a company, and I was driving around metro Atlanta, and all of a sudden the intuitive voice said, you're driving towards the bar he works at. Maybe it's time to pull in and make that amends. And then the dialogue with myself started. I said, no, I'm not going to do this. And so then I started to think, well, he's a bartender, and it's like 2 or 3 in the afternoon. The chances of him being at work right now are slim to none, but I can tell my sponsor that I became willing. He just wasn't there. And so I pulled into this restaurant where my ex-girlfriend had worked and he had worked. In the middle of the afternoon, I walk in and he's standing behind the bar. And so I walked up to him and I asked him if he had a few minutes, and we sat down at this bar. And I told him how I regretted what I had done and how I had been wrong. And I wanted to do whatever I could to make things right between us. And I asked him if he wanted to tell me how any of this made him feel. And he just broke down and he begged for my forgiveness. And now, not all amends happen that way, because the people in the world are quite often wrong. You know, but to go as far as to understanding how wrong they are is as far as we ever went. Right. And so I made that amends. This is the part of the story that I love. My father and I, almost every Sunday, we would go to this restaurant, and this guy would come over and he would personally wait on us from the bar. So we began to cultivate a relationship. 2.5 years ago, I go in with one of my grandsponsees to have lunch. And Tony, the guy I made amends to years ago, comes up to us. He and I embrace, and we just start catching up. And so I sit down at the table for the meal with my grandsponsee, and I tell him the story, and he said I was making it up. He's like, there's no way you caught that guy having sex with your girlfriend. The way you were just acting with one another would lead me to believe you've been friends your entire life. This is what's available to us in this amends process. And, I slept with my best friend's fiance. This was another thing that I did, and I carried a great deal of guilt around. And so when I got clean and sober, he was on my list, and I went and made amends to her, and I went and made amends to him. But what had happened is we had a huge group of friends, and some of the friends found out what was going on, so they would approach us and say, if you guys don't tell him, we're going to tell him. And there was this back and forth struggle, so this whole entire group of friends was segregated, and that was the effect. So I had to go make amends to everyone in that circle of people. And so, I got clean and sober in 2007. I went to make this amends with this couple in 2008. The event that took place was in 2003. I'm laying out a timeline for a specific reason, because I took this couple out to dinner to make amends to them. And I made amends for robbing them of emotional security, for putting them in a position where they had to choose between their friends, and certain people couldn't hang out with each other anymore. And I also wanted to make amends for using their apartment, because we used to meet. When they'd be out of town, we would meet at their place without them knowing to have sex. And they're sitting at dinner with me, and they both looked at each other like deer in headlights. And I was like, what's going on? See, one of those times, she and I had used a condom, and we had not disposed of the condom. This married couple found a used condom in their bedroom that they didn't know where it came from. So for 5 years, they each questioned the other one for cheating. Okay. If I had not become willing to make that amends, though, that couple would never have gotten the closure that they needed. And I tell that story because of the ripple effect. We actually think it's a pretty direct, I harmed you, but we don't know the fallout of all of this. And so over the years, I always share these stories as I'm going into step 10, and I can share much, much more, but because of owning a program and being very active in the 12 step for so long, I'm convinced that long-term sobriety is directly connected to making amends. Because every time someone relapses and they come to me, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to say, you made an 8-step list the first time you went through the steps. I want you to tell me what happened with that 8-step list and how many of those amends you made. Without fail, invariably you're going to find they didn't make all their amends. They didn't even try. Usually they'll make mom and dad, sister, brother, maybe their most recent employer, a couple of close friends. Why? Not that those are not emotional. They're very emotional because those are the people closest to us. But chances are those individuals are not going to spit in your face and throw you out the door and say, don't ever come back. But when I had to go seek out a guy who had given me 1,000 hits of ecstasy and I took off on him, right? This was years and years ago. That was a scary amends, because I'd heard around town he had told people if he ever found me, he was going to do something to me. And so I was, I was 6 years sober, and I went and found him, this guy. He had tried to help me. Like, he wasn't just a guy down on the block that I used to rip off for a couple 20 rocks, right? The way I made amends to those was I donated money to the homeless shelter. Okay, there are ways to make all of these amends. And so I sought out this guy who had given me all this ecstasy, and I owed him thousands and thousands of dollars. And I went to him, and I told him that, you know, I thanked him for taking me under his wing and trying to, he broke bread with me. He invited me into his home. And every time I'd fall and ruin everything, he's the one that would give me something to sell in order to get back up on my feet. And I disrespected him, and I took off. And I said, I want to set up a payment plan to pay you back. Last November of 2017, I gave him the last payment. Right? This man comes to me wanting to start a website that is a general clearinghouse. So people with different types of problems, like domestic violence and children that have been abandoned and drug addiction, can go to this website and get all the information they need to find out who they need to contact. And he comes to me to ask me for advice on it. And then his brother-in-law is an alcoholic. He has me go get his brother out of detox and 12-step him, and then I got to go sit down with the family and explain to them what the 12 steps were going to be about, and have that conversation that very few of us get to have, that's in the chapter to the wives and family afterward, where there are specific things that we're supposed to discuss with families about this problem. What would happen if I had not become willing to make those amends? I share these stories because I want you to know it's possible to make all your amends. It took me a long period of reconstruction, right? Isn't that what the book says? It's not going to happen overnight. But from what I've observed from watching individuals, I can tell you that very few people make their amends. It's very seldom the topic at a discussion meeting. And why is that? Because very few people make their amends. And so it's my responsibility to share with you that it is possible. It can take a very long time. I've paid back $20,000 in my time here. I've still got more money to pay back. I'm not done with my financial amends. But what I stress to the guys I sponsor is like, look, you know, I've been sober for 10 years. That's 120 months. I can guarantee you out of those 120 months, I've probably sent some level of financial amends out into the universe, at least 85 to 90 of those months. Sometimes it was $25. Other times it was $400. But it's being in the action of all of that. I'm convinced that all of the personal and professional success that I've had over these 11 years is directly connected to the amount of energy I've spent in trying to repair the damage from the past and the amount of self-sacrifice in taking people through the 12 steps. Directly correlated. You know, the big book's really clear about this idea of self-sacrifice. And Bill, in his story, he says if we as addicts and alcoholics fail to perfect and enlarge our spiritual life through what? Through work and self-sacrifice for others, we're not going to survive the certain trials and low spots. I would not have survived losing my marriage and my father in the same month had it not been for adhering to that phrase in our big book. The men that took me through this process, they pushed me and pushed me. They said, this is what it's about. You will have to sacrifice your time. It will be inconvenient for you to sponsor people. And that's what I teach. And so when we look through the steps, everybody's looking for that rainbows and unicorns and the stars and one specific step. If I write this the right kind of inventory, I'll have this aha moment. If I do enough fifth steps, I'll have this aha moment. You know, if I do the third step up on the top of a mountain and something's just powerful is going to happen, right? To me, it's not about that. To me, it's about the entire body of work is a submission process. And in the first nine steps are the launching pad into the world of the Spirit. And that's what this workshop's about this morning, is entering the world of the Spirit. And what does that mean? Well, you can't enter the world of the Spirit based on these 12 steps without doing the work in the first nine steps. That's a requirement here. And so I focused the first part of this discussion on that because I want you to see the connection, because that's what the book says, is this thought brings us to step 10, right? Our next function now is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. So what are we understanding now? To me, the spiritual realm is what we're trying to understand, because we want to be more effective in the human realm. And that when they split those that phrase, understanding of ineffectiveness, that's the way I look at it. As we develop as humans, I think some of as our moral development progresses, our conceptions about God change. Think about it. When we get into early recovery, we are just trying to regroup here morally. Not that we were morally bad, but we have a new set of principles we're trying to live by. We didn't live by those principles prior to this. So therefore, if we're living by a new set of principles, indirectly, it's going to change our moral makeup. Okay? And as that progresses, the way we look at God, the way we look at prayer, the way we look at meditation, everything will change. And this is a good thing, because this is where the dogma and the doctrine of all traditions, not any single one tradition, will decline the curiosity to investigate and inquiry, which to me, the 10th and 11th step is entirely about inquiry and investigation. It can be really fun and exciting. If you're able to go to one line, one phrase in our book that says, be quick to see where religious people are right and make use of what they offer. And those two sentences in our big book, they were pushed upon me by my teachers to go find out. And so as we progress, when we first arrive here, we're in this phase called self-survival. Are we not? We're all in survival. And it's an unthinking mode, and it's very, very instinctful. It's based on our instincts. Somewhere along the way, I don't know where it happens for some people in recovery, but we transition from this self-survival mode to what I call a blaming sense of self. And don't take the word blaming in a negative way. Now, the big book says our troubles are all of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and we are extreme examples of self-will run riot. That, to me, has a lot of freedom attached to it, because if my problems are of your making, I'm totally screwed, okay? But if all my problems are of my own making, that means that you and the world and everything in the world does not have to change for me to be okay. And that's the greatest statement of hope that you're going to find in this big book. And as we transition into that, and if you really think about it, when I went through the steps the first time, and they talk about this psychic change, I don't know about you, but I never did a personal inventory before I got to the 12 steps. So I spent my entire life knowing who had wronged me. I knew what you did to wrong me. If you said, Tarek, how does this affect you? I could describe to you how it affected me. But I never in my life entirely set aside what the other person had done and resolutely looked for my own mistakes and where I was at fault. So as I went through the process the first time, and in my fifth step, my sponsor would always say, he's like, so how's this trouble of your own making? How's this trouble? Even being molested at 5, how's that trouble of your own making? I said, well, that 5-year-old kid didn't do anything to create that trouble. But he said, how long have you lived justifying your behavior based on what happened 26 years ago? And then he got me with that. It was a hard pill to swallow. You've described it beautifully, you know, that how long have I spent my life doing things that I didn't want to do, that I had this illness that manifested itself in me doing things I didn't want to do. Is it perhaps possible my cousin was suffering from an illness that manifested in that way, and he was doing things he didn't want to do, or she was doing things she didn't want to do? Okay, does that make sense? And when you said that the other night or the other morning, it was true. I didn't have to even contemplate whether or not it was true. And so we get into this blaming sense of self, but it's a development of a conscience. That's what I mean by a blaming sense of self. And that's one of the things that's required here. As we travel a spiritual path, it's important that we have this self-examination and we continuously have a self-reckoning with ourselves. So when I interact with people, and this is part of a 10th step. So what I'm describing is an active 10th step. And I'm going to break it down here in a little bit, but there's watch, ask, turn, cease fighting. They're all out of the big book. I watch my internal space for resentment. I watch for dishonesty. I watch for selfishness. As these things begin to crop up inside of me, as I'm observing, I ask. I begin a dialogue with my higher power. You know, I can ask God to remove them. I can ask for some clarity. I can ask for some understanding of why I'm having this experience, right? And then the big book says that I'm to turn my thoughts to someone I can help. Turn my thoughts to my sponsees. Turn my thoughts to my family. Whatever it is, turn your thoughts. Okay, let's say I go through that process, okay? I watch, I ask, I turn. I try to practice a code of love and tolerance. I'm trying to cease fighting. These are all the things you can practice in a 10 step as you're walking through your day. And I'm still gripped by it. Discuss it with someone immediately. All right. And then you have to reflect. If you're doing reflection and self-examination, you will see whether or not you stepped on someone's toes. You need to go make an amends very quickly. This is what we do here. This is a walking around step. This is not a step that I do at the end of the day. One of the most, I won't say watered down, confusing things in AA and CA that I hear is the 10 steps about writing inventory at the end of the day, and it's not. The 10 steps about walking around, it's about how I engage with you all day long. It's about staying awake. It's about the intent. It's about the vision. And we all fall asleep. I get that. We all fall asleep. But once we enter this blaming sense of self and we begin to develop a conscience, you can't have a conscience unless you're reflecting on how you're showing up in life. Yeah. And so as we move through this evolution, we enter this, what I call, and what one of my mentors calls, is an inspired sense of self. And now you have this development of what we call the sixth sense in the big book, the God conscious at the very end of the 10th step. It's intuition. The little voice that talks to you, not the one that lies to you, but the one that talks to you. And we've all experienced it, right? We get that little nudge and then we do something and we make a mistake and you're like, damn it, I heard that voice, right? We all do it. And so we move into the inspired sense of self. And this happened to me, you know, there's a man that came into my life back in 2009. I listened to him on CD, and he stressed this step 10 and 11. And then this other man I run into expresses the importance of the intuition. The hardest thing about trusting God is trusting God. Right? He said that to me, and I was like, oh, okay. I didn't have a comeback for him when he said it. I said, I get it. So we have that inspired sense of self, but it's a practice. Practice, practice, practice. My late grand sponsor, my former sponsor, would call him up and he would say to him, man, I can't stay present. I can't watch myself. I'm not aware enough to ask. And my grand sponsor would just say, practice, 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 click. And he would just hang up the phone. And that's what that was about, was like understanding that there is no arrival place. We hear this all the time, but especially in these two steps, in 10 and 11, there is no arrival place. It's just a constant practice and vigilance. Because at somewhere along the way, you're going to go from an inspired sense of self where you're doing creative exploration, reading all these books. Like I love the 12 steps. They're divinely inspired. I love the big book. But there is so much out there, so much more, okay? And somewhere along the way, you'll go from this just being open to intuitive thoughts to actually trusting your insights, even if you make a mistake, because the mistake was what was supposed to happen to begin with. See, we go through life and we make mistakes and we get lessons. What I believe is that if we don't get the lesson, we will continue to have the same experience. It may look differently, but it's still supposed to produce the same lesson. And sometimes the mistakes that are happening are what was supposed to happen, evidenced by them happening, right? And so they call this the tranquility phase, where you trust yourself. You know, who in here, you know, shops your answers out, right? When you have something, you're uncertain about what you want to do. So you go through and you call like 10 people, and then you're more confused than you were at the beginning, right? At some point, you have to begin to practice trusting your own insights. And then they say, well, that's a scary thing for an addict and alcoholic. Not if you've been practicing these two steps, right? And not if you're clear from your past, which is step 9. Get clear of your past, and what I mean by that, don't run away from it, but go confront it, right? And then the ultimate goal here, and I'm nowhere near this, but they call it a self-actualization phase, where you actually will communicate with everyone in your life by knowing that they're a manifestation of the same power that manifested you, and that's how you interact with people. You know, so that you hear namaste all the time, or you hear the spirit in me sees the spirit in you. I said the other night, you know, what's looking out from behind your eyes? Is it possibly the same thing that's looking out from behind my eyes looking at you? Is there something that deepens our connection and will complete our human being, really, at the end of the day? So these phases that I'm describing to you are embedded in these steps. Now, again, I've used these steps along with some other things. That's how I'm bringing you this morning. That's what I'll hopefully always do. I never do anything instead of what's in the big book. I always do things along with what's in the big book. And so when I'm taking it, so the next thing I want to do now is I want to show you how I implement this with a sponsee. So I get a guy, he gets to step 9. We do not move in the process until he completes 3 to 5 amends. I won't even talk to him anymore. Every time he calls me, I'm going to be like, how many? All right. Once he's got 3 to 5 amends under his belt, I'm going to get with him, and we're going to cover steps 10 and 11. Now, he's been doing step 11 since the very beginning. When I meet with sponsees, the first thing we're going to do is meditate. First time I meet with him is 4 minutes. After that, we go up 1 minute every time we meet because they have to meditate. And they're going to do it with me. And then we're going to pray. I teach them this prayer called the set-aside prayer. 1 week I pray, 1 week they pray. And we just go back and forth. So they're at least going to pray with me, and they're going to learn how to meditate with me. And then when we get to step 10, for 1 week I have him get a bunch of 3x5 index cards. And he writes the word watch on one index card that's going to go in his pocket. One goes on his nightstand. Another one goes on the mirror in his bathroom. He's going to put one on his refrigerator. He's going to put one on his dashboard in his car. And then he's going to put one, if he has an office, he's going to put one on his computer at work. I want that word plastered everywhere so he's remembering. So he watches. And he'll always ask me, what am I watching for? Selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. I don't want you to do anything when these crop up. I just want you to begin to be a guardian for your inner space. Know what the hell is going on inside of you. If you're around a person that makes your toes curl, ask yourself, why is this person making my toes curl? Right? If I seem to get anxious in certain situations, why is it these situations create anxiety and these don't? So I just want you to begin to watch. And that's it. We're not going to have a discussion. I just want you to observe yourself. He comes back a week later and we'll say, okay, now you throw away those index cards. Now we're going to get a new set of index cards. Same locations. You're going to put watch dash ask. So now you're going to begin watching. And then I want you to talk to God. You can use the fear prayer. A lot of times it's fear. God, please remove my fear. Direct my attention to what you'd have me be. But I throw in, ask God to give you some clarity and understanding of why you're having the experience and see what happens with that. And so we began watch, ask for a week. The next week, we throw those cards away. Now it's watch, dash, ask, turn. Watch, communicate with God, turn back to what you were doing. Turn your thoughts to someone you can help over and over. And then this is a practice. I'm always telling them there's no perfection here. It's just practice. You'll forget for 2 hours. And then all of a sudden, it's there. And then the fourth week is watch, ask, turn, and then my favorite, cease. Cease fighting anything or anyone, even drugs and alcohol. All right. And so that's our 1 month practice of step 10. Now, something in addition is this concept of the position of neutrality that the big book talks about. And to me, that's parallels cease fighting. Stop fighting, be neutral. Right. And then I talk to them about vision. You walk into a meeting of Cocaine Anonymous and you ask everybody, you know, who prays? Every hand in the place is going to go up. Then you ask them who prays and meditates, and you'll see about half to two-thirds of the room is going to raise their hands. Then you ask who prays, meditates, and works with vision. Very few hands. Mm-hmm. But the big book strictly says every day is a day when I must carry a vision of God's will into all my activities. So how do we tie that into this? I tie it in at the 11th step. It says we consider our plans for the day. We think about the 24 hours ahead. Have you ever noticed how they say the same thing? Consider your plans for the day. Think about the 24 hours ahead. So I asked about this. The answer I got was consider your plans for the day is the actions and the doings of the day. And thinking about the 24 hours a day is more of your being. I want to be trusting today. I want to be grateful today. I want to be conscious of my inner space today, right? I want to see God in everybody today. Those are states of consciousness or being. And so you can create a vision in your morning prayer life or your step 11 for anything you want, really. Like this morning, I sat in meditation and I created a vision in my mind of how I wanted this to go. Right? It's not going according to that vision, but you know, but it's the practice. It's the practice. It's the practice was more important than the result. Okay, the practice is more important than the result. And so that's how I teach a 10th step to someone. The 10th step, in my opinion, is by far the hardest step to practice. You know, it's not like you're just going to walk out one day and you're going to start watching and asking and turning and cease fighting. You know, I've been doing this since 2000, I would say late 2009, and I'm way better than I was in 2009. And in 2028, I'm going to be way better than I am now. So it's just about movement, evolution, and growth in this step. But I am convinced that steps 10 and 11 is the language of the heart. That is where all the juice in our program is. You know, it's like when you're catapulted out of step 9, you open this door into this inner spiritual realm, and you ask yourself, how am I going to learn how to navigate through the spiritual realm? Well, steps 10 and 11 are unlike the way you and I live life. They're just, we've never done this. Watch, ask, turn. Practicing a code of love and tolerance, stop fighting, position of neutrality, practicing and cultivating a sixth sense. We don't do any of that. It's not natural, but we begin to practice. And if you practice long enough, it's like brushing your teeth, then it just starts to happen. It's not like I made a decision to brush my teeth this morning. It's just one of the things I do every morning. And so as it becomes integrated into the way you live, the same thing will happen. And it's hard to ever talk about step 10 without talking about step 11. Now, step 11, first I want to share with you where the confusion comes about step 10. Okay, who in here, and don't be shy, but who in here realized that step 10 is a walking around step, or did you think step 10 was about an inventory or a spot check inventory or any of that? Because for years, I was a Joe and Charlie guy for a year and 9 months, and I thought I knew the 10th step in and out. I thought it was doing 4 through 9 at the end of the day, a quick way to do 4 through 9. And then I listened to my late grand sponsor. I'll never forget it. And I was like, I'm a big book guy. And I listened to him break down the 10th step. I was like, what big book is this guy reading? And I got home, and because I'd never looked, you know, everyone taught me you read 86 to 88 in the morning. And then I get hooked up with this new guy. He's like, no, you read 84 to 88 in the morning. And so I walk into some meetings and I start talking about 84 to 88. And I got all these other guys, what are you talking about 84 to 88? And so he broke down 84 and 88. But then I went to the 12 and 12. And I'm a fan of the 12 and 12. There's no instructions on how to do anything in the 12 and 12. But those are good essays in the 12 and 12. And in the 10th step, you know, Bill had 15 years of experience at this point. So for him, his 10th step had changed. And that's what you got out of the 12 and 12 was a spot check inventory, an assets versus liabilities inventory, or inventorying your day. There's three. So it's not that one is right and one is wrong. I just love the big book because it's the collective conscience that wrote that book. Mm-hmm. It wasn't one man's opinion. Mm-hmm. And that's why I do it out of the book. And the 10th step, it's the only way that I can really pay attention about my interactions with you. Now, I said this on Thursday night, but I used to be a guy that believed that my spiritual condition was based on how many times I meditated, how long I meditated, how many sponsees I had, how many service commitments I had, how many this and that. Just that was the litmus test. And then about 4.5-5 years ago, I met this man, and he introduced me to these concepts of self-examination and self-reckoning. And he said, you know, the only way to truly see spirituality is in the day-to-day life. He said spirituality is not other world. It's not unicorns. It's not this ephemeral place that we're trying to get to. He said it's embedded in existence on a day-to-day basis. And the only way we can really see that is how we interact with people. And so then I was trying to take my conversation with him and put it into the 12 steps. And I said, well, this is like a 10 step. Watch, ask, turn. All of it is as I'm interacting with God's kids. And so it made a lot of sense. And so that's what I want to stress this morning is that 10th step is how we play with in the sandbox. All right. And we've never been people that play well in sandboxes. And so that's our wrapping of the 10th step. Before we start step 11, I want to answer any questions that anyone in here has. Or at least give you my experience with the question.
I've never heard like vision of God's will into all my activities said the way like, you know, that you actually visualize what you want to create in that context. Can you just extend a little bit more?
So carrying a vision of God's will into all my activities. Right. Okay, so there's two ways of looking at this. The first is the way I did this morning. Like I sat down, you know, I sat down in meditation, and inside of my meditation at the very beginning, I said some prayers, and then I just began to observe. And the intent behind the observation was how this was going to unfold, mm-hmm. right? What did I want to share with you? You know, how much of my, how vulnerable did I want to make myself this morning? And so I would begin. So I would begin to observe all of those thoughts happening to me. That's the vision work. You know, I'm using a spiritual tool, a spiritual practice to help me be effective here.
So you're aware of God's will.
I don't, I'm not a guy that believes there's a separation from God's will and self-will.
I got it.
All right.
I got it.
To me, anytime it's like for me, anything I say about my own conception of God, please feel free to discount it. That's not the place for this, really. We're trying to show people how to get to God, their own version of God, right? I heard this story. My sponsor told the story, but it wasn't his story. So I don't know where the story comes from. But if we assume that, let's use Las Vegas, the city of lights, that's LA, but we'll say Las Vegas for all the roller coasters and all the crazy looking buildings, and just it's just sensory overload when you're in Las Vegas. And let's assume our God, our spiritual awakening to some level is going to get us to a place that equates to that. What I find that we do sometimes is we try to impose our version of Las Vegas on people. And that's not what I want to do today. I'm not imposing anything on you. I'm just trying to show you part of the path that gets you to Vegas, and you find out what Vegas is for yourself. And so part of my Vegas says there's no separation between self-will and God's will. If God is the ocean and self-will is the wave, it's the same thing. And so I want to see God in everything. So if I were to say God is love, well, that's limited then, because everything outside of love is God. And so God has to be unlimited. So I can't say God is only love. God's also the darkness for me. It helps me understand this world. At least in my crazy mind, it does. There's another. So when I make decisions, have you ever heard someone say, I'm going to sit with that? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're asking, what does that mean? So I'm going to show you my version of sitting with something. Let's say I have a decision to make, and I'm very uncertain about the decision. And so what I'll do in meditation is I will pay attention to what part of my body is affected by the decision. If it's landing in my chest and my heart, usually an indicator that I need to make the decision. But if it's down in my solar plexus, there's something uncertain about it. So I'm going to maybe do my best to steer clear, because that's an indicator that there's something just not right about it for me. Okay, and I will do that for multiple days, right? And so I meant to share about this the other night when I spoke, but so that statement I made, the hardest thing about trusting God is trusting God. So in 2015, I wanted to start my own business. I've always worked for someone else. And at the beginning of 2015, I went into my employer and said, you know, I want a raise. And they said no. And so I copped the resentment. And I started investigating what it was going to take for me to start my own business. And I wanted a recovery center. And I wanted a recovery center modeled after my late grand sponsor's recovery center, 12-step immersion, incorporating healthy diets and physical fitness and recreational activity. That's what I wanted. And so I wrote this elaborate business plan. I have a finance background, so that part of it was easy. And I started shopping the business plan, and then I found an investor. An investor says, "I'll give you the money you need." And so I signed a letter of intent. This was in May or June of 2015. And so I started, but I wasn't going to get the money until January 1st of 2016. And so I had this current job, and I would go to my quarterly meetings, and they would do these five-year plans, and the five-year plan would always have me being promoted and becoming a district manager. And I began to live a lie, because they're sitting there telling me how they're going to build all these things around me, and I'm not going to be there. So I went to one of my mentors, and he said, "You'll get to a turning point, and you're going to be compelled to be honest." And I would say to him, I'm like, "I'm not going to tell them, because we just bought a house. I have a massive mortgage. My ex-wife and I had bought a house. We had this little girl. We have these two cars, big house, all the little toys that society says you're supposed to have. And I'm scared. If I go in there and tell them I'm leaving on December 31st, they could take my job from me now. And there's no way we can pay for all of this." And so in August, I'm sitting in my VP's office, and the VP says, "What's going on with you?" And the same dialogue happened in my head, the voice saying, "It's time to tell them." And I'm like, "No, it's not." And so finally, I remember this. I was sitting in his chair in his office, and I got up to leave, and then I sat back down, one of those numbers, and I told him. I said, "Look, I'm December 31st is going to be my last day here." And we had a wonderful conversation. All of the fears were so fabricated. And he said, "No, no," he goes, "You're fine." And he goes, "But one thing, before you make your final decision, let me know how much money it's going to take to keep you here." And I was like, "Why are you doing this now? If you had just given me the raise in January, we wouldn't be sitting here." And so I ignored him. I completely ignored him. And at the end of September, it happened again. He was going up for his fourth quarter meetings at the corporate office, and he comes into my office on a Friday, and he says to me, "Look, I'm going to Missouri. I want you to create your own job description, however much money you want to make, and I'm going to try to get this from the CEO when I go up there." And so I did. I spent that weekend creating a job description, and I put the price tag where I was like, "There's no way they're going to give me this, but I'm going to put it in here anyway." And he comes back, and he goes, "Hey, you got it." I was like, "Holy shit." So then I began to move into prayer. And I began to sit with him. And so every morning I'm asking God, please, give me some guidance and direction. I need some clarity. I don't know what to do. And my prayer life always has been conversational. Mm-hmm. It's not these set, this is what, third step, seventh step. Mm-hmm. I like conversations. I like the set aside prayer. And then sometimes it does flow into the third and the seventh step. Mm-hmm. But there's mixing it up. And I asked God one morning to make it obvious. And be careful. If you're going to ask God to make it obvious, that means something drastic is going to have to happen for it to be obvious. So I said, "Please make it obvious." And so in that house, I had a meditation room. And so I come out of the meditation room, and my wife and daughter have already left for the day. And I come downstairs, and on the coffee table, there was a drawing that Callie was at that age where she drew, and she left her drawings all over the house. And on the middle of the coffee table, I still have it framed on my office desk to this day, was this little piece of paper, had this red box with these stars around it, and in the middle of the red box it said, "Follow your dream." And my jaw hit the floor, and I said, I just said this prayer. The same morning I used the prayer for the very first time, I called Marcy, my ex-wife, and I was like, "Did you put her up to this?" She's like, "No, of course I wouldn't do that." And so Callie gets home from school. I said, Callie, why did you write this? She goes, "I don't know. I was supposed to write that today." And so I made my decision based on that.
Wow.
I passed up more money than I'd ever made. I'm making half of that now. But I did what I did my vision. I did my dream. So what I'm trying to do this morning is I really want to give you best practices. I want you to walk out of this room with something tangible that you can practice. Not just hearing my experience, but an actual methodology to implementing these steps. Okay? So now let's talk about step 11. Unless there's another question about 10 before I move on. Any other questions? All right. Now 11 is... Sometimes I feel like 11 is something that we just fall into out of habit. Like we're supposed to do it, so we do it. We don't ever investigate why we're doing it. And about 2 years ago, I heard a man say that prayer without the presence of the heart is invalid. And that set me down. I mean, it really, and then I began to question, you know, well, how do I know if my heart's present or not? And then he asked a series of questions. He said, why are you praying? He said, prayer without knowledge of why you're praying is invalid. He said, you must investigate why you're praying. What are you doing? How is this relevant? And do you actually cultivate the expectancy of God when you're praying? And this is one of my mentors. So I took all these notes. Because we were talking about prayer. And the things I walked away from, you know, now granted, the big book has wonderful instructions for us. They tell you what to do when you retire at night. They tell you what to do upon awakening. Now, the interesting thing on when you retire at night is the big book originally in the manuscript said tomorrow morning when we wake up, we'll review the day before. And so I have guys that I'll say you can either do your review at night, you can do it first thing in the morning. I don't really mind which one you do. Do you think Bill was convinced that our thinking was messed up? Have you ever looked at how many times in pages 86, 87, 88 that he refers to our thought life and our thinking? He's trying to tell us we need help bad. And we need a way to put us back in the center, line us back up with God's will best we can. Okay? And that is acknowledgement. So for me, prayer life is about acknowledging the presence of God. Sometimes we get these vivid answers to our prayers, and other times we don't. Other times we're just left bewildered, baffled, and confused, which is okay. And so I had to begin asking myself, why do I pray? And these last 4 years with the opioid crisis have really shown me something. I've watched more people I know in our little recovery community. We have these two groups that we all attend. We have probably lost 50 people in the last 2 years, at least. All right. Now, why is it that, for whatever reason, this power wakes me up every morning with the same degree of willingness I had the day before? And it's done this for almost 11 years. I begin to ask that question. Because I spent 3 years at the Salvation Army, sparring the guys down there. I met some of the smartest, most articulate men I have ever met in my entire life working at the Sally. And I would go down there on Saturday nights. We'd do this big book workshop. I'd come down there throughout the week. I'd sponsor these guys. I'd listen to their first step. And these men, where their addictions took them, made mine look like a walk in the park, a Sunday picnic. But yet... my ass is down there every Saturday and a couple days during the week sponsoring them. And they're gung-ho in the wintertime, and as soon as spring hits, they're gone. Right? This was usually the MO. There was only one man that I worked with over the span of 3 years that's still clean and sober to this day. I don't know why that is, but what I began to question is, why do I have the willingness and these guys don't? And their first step's much lower than mine. Their bottom is much lower. Why aren't they committed? And then I quit asking the question. The question went away, and I just became thankful. And it was through this exercise of asking myself, why do I pray? Because the willingness is not – I'm not the source of the willingness either for me, right? It just doesn't make any sense when you look at all these people. This guy should be willing to do this work, but he's not, all right? And so that was one of the reasons that I came up with after doing this exercise. And the way I bring my heart into my prayer life, so this morning at the beginning of my meditation, I just focused my intent on my heart, that I wanted to have a longing for God. I wanted to be closer to God. I wanted to think about God more. I kept on thanking God, and it was just here in my chest. At the very beginning of my meditation, for like 2 to 4 minutes, that's what I'm doing. I'm bringing my heart present into this. That's the only way I have found him to have this statement true, but it really concerned me when he said it the first time, because I began to question if my heart was really present, because I began to reflect on all the years, because I drifted in and out of mechanical prayer life. I think everyone in this room does, you know, mechanical prayer life. And then the practice of it just blossomed into something else. You know, now that time sitting in the morning and just thinking about God and like how much I love God becomes part of the morning routine. Oh, it's not like I'm just checking off another box, you know. Oh, you know, I come from a lineage where step 10 and 11 is, you know, that's the be all and end all. I've got to spend my time in it, blah, 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 blah. It's not like that. It's really about figuring out a way to practice the expectancy of God. How do I cultivate the expectancy of God? And how do we do it is relaxed but vigilant awareness. And that is done by actually paying attention to why we're doing these things. Why am I praying? Why am I meditating? Asking ourselves. Not because it was handed down in some doctrine or dogma, which this might sound like heresy, but the 12 steps are that as well. Right? The 12 steps are that as well. And so we have to think outside of this. I used to be a very rigid, this is the way you have to do it. No, the steps can be very fluid, and they can be – remember, the realm of the Spirit's broad and roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding. That would apply to the steps as well. And so that's what I take into the steps, because it will remove – the black and white from it, and we enter this gray area, which gray for spirituality is really good. If you were able to get rid of this dualistic view, and we begin to see the unity in everything, right? We begin to see, if you can see God in everything, you see unity in everything. And there is a unity that pervades the underlying existence of life, right? I'm quoting a book that I read, but that was one of my favorite statements in the book. It's an underlying part of existence that we're trying to tap into to really experience some time of full liberation. And the really interesting thing is when you tap into it this way, you'll begin to see that the scriptures completely change. The meaning of scriptures changes when we have this curiosity to relax our fixed ideas, investigate, move forward with the ideas you just investigated, or you're excited because I got a bunch of new ideas now. Right, but we get into these traditions that don't allow that. And I was very fortunate. When I got into meditation, I was on the phone with my sponsor, and he's like, man, why don't you just go to the Buddhists? They've been doing it for 2,500 years. And so I started I just moved back in my parents' house. I had about a year and, I don't know, 9 months. And I'm walking my dog, and I'm literally a half a mile from my parents' house. And all of a sudden, I'm walking down the street, and I look up, and there's this entrance into this property. And it's got two brick walls. And in one of the walls has a banner on it. It says, free meditation classes. And I'm just like, you got to be kidding me. And so I call my sponsor, and I tell him. And he's like, okay, go find out what it is. And he probably already knew it was a Buddhist monastery, but all these years I grew up a half a mile from a Buddhist monastery and never knew it. And it because it was set off the road. And so I went back and they offered these classes. It was a Zen monastery. It was all nuns. And they taught us how to meditate, and they taught us about Buddhism. And I did this in the spring and in the fall for 2 years. And so now I had some real palpable experience with meditation. And that was exciting to me, because you walked into a Buddhist monastery and they don't care what religion you are. They'll teach you Buddhism. And it was such a beautiful thing to open up to. So I went through that phase. And then I went through my Christian mysticism phase, Thomas Merton. I was obsessed with Thomas Merton. I would read all these books. I'd go out to the Catholic monastery. We were doing these 3-day retreats. And then I got into Taoism. And now I've gotten into to the other mystical traditions, and I've finally settled on one I've been studying for the last 5 years. And granted, I'm trying to be as general as possible because it's for you to find out what interests you. But what I'm trying to stress here is the relaxing, you know, and just investigating. And just it's that curiosity can make steps 10 and 11 so much fun. But if it's just black and white and this is the way you have to do it, it's gonna become stale. That's one of the most common questions I get from sponsees. Eventually, every sponsee is going to call me and tell me my prayer life is mechanical. My meditations are stale. They're not producing anything. I had one sponsee call me. This was about 5 months ago. He says to me, he goes, "I'm not getting connected in the morning, man. I'm doing my practices and I'm just not getting connected and I'm suffering throughout the course of the day." And I said to him, I said, "Hold on a second. So why do you pray and meditate?" He goes, "So I don't suffer during the day." I said, "So your prayer and meditation has nothing to do with devotion to God. You're just doing it for yourself?" And he's like, "Yeah." I was like, there's something wrong with that, don't you think? And he's like, "Yeah." And so we talked about devotion. You know, I do have a high degree of reverence towards this power we call God. Because any one of us can walk out that door and our ticket gets punched. And just like that, it changes. But can we live life knowing that? And then we become much more respectful towards this power. You know, my favorite word for God is the great observer. Right? He or she is always watching. And to me, when you begin to cultivate the expectancy of God, the observer is always there with you, witnessing your life. And then you have to ask yourself, how are you living life? So that's my little take on steps 10 and 11. These steps have been just as exciting as the 12 step in sponsorship. I can't say they're more exciting or one's more exciting than the other. I used to say it was all step 12. I don't say that anymore. There's so much here in steps 10 and 11. And it is the part of the steps that I don't think people settle for. I got to do these prayers, and this is what the 10th step is, and there's nothing more to it. But my buddy, I got a friend named Charlie who says the pages in the big book are 500 feet deep. How deep do you want to go? You know, another one of my mentors used to say, how free do you want to be? How much of this do you want? If you want to settle for this much, you can it's there. If you want as much as you can carry, it's also there. But there's so many books out there you can incorporate into these steps, right? And, you know, one of the most powerful prayers you can say is pray asking God for knowledge of his will and the power to carry that out. And for me, the knowledge of his will is knowing everything's his will and to still have the power to move through. That, to me, is that how that prayer unfolds for me. It doesn't have to unfold that way for you. We can start from something simple, but there are people, like, it's like anything else in life. If you want something, go find someone that's doing it a way that's attractive to you and go ask them what they do. We always think we have to reinvent the wheel. These things that I shared with you this morning, because I stumbled across people that had been doing it longer than me and I asked them how they did it. Mm-hmm. Same thing, right? If you observe excellence in someone, just go ask them, hey, how'd you get here? And then do what they did. And it can be that simple. But it requires a massive commitment, just like everything else. Now that I've owned this center for the last 2.5 years, I will tell you that I'm a guy that believes if you're committed, it doesn't matter what step you're on, you're going to be safe and protected. Let me explain to you what I mean by that. So I'll have a guy come in, he's super committed. And this also applies to sponsees. And then somewhere between 30 and 90 days, he starts going to the gym, right? And he starts getting on all these protein supplements, and he's taking just as much as he can to not be taking steroids. And now the body image is what he's committed to. He's still going to meetings. He still has a sponsor. He's still working the steps, but it's not the number one commitment. His body image becomes the number one commitment. Other individuals is making up for lost time. They become committed because they've been so absent from the family, that becomes their commitment. Not knowing that if that becomes the commitment, recovery is no longer the number one commitment. And it doesn't matter. You can slide anything into that top slot. Every single time, if recovery falls to second place, that's not good enough. And the commitment begins to waver, and then this grace and this safety and the protection goes away. I've been watching it. That's one of the things I love to do. I love to watch people. I like to see like when things begin. I'd like to think that I'm watching how things begin to unravel for people. One of the things I've picked up on is just commitment.
Yeah.
Right. I had this one kid I sponsored. I said, look, here's the deal. You meet with me once or twice a week. You're going to call me every day. I don't care if I pick up the phone or not. You need to call me every day. And we're going to go through these steps, and you're going to you have to go to one of these two meetings, otherwise I won't work with you. And the entire time, this kid was committed, 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 committed. I mean, he called me every day at the same time for the better part of a year. And he got all the results. And then I get these other guys, you know, they don't. They're not committed. You know, maybe commitment and surrender can be used interchangeably. But the commitment is a huge deal. And the steps 10 and 11 are no different. They require a commitment. Either you're going to commit to being curious and investigate, or you're going to settle.
Right.
You know, and when you settle, it always gets boring.
Yeah.
And as we all know, boredom for addicts is life-threatening.
Right.
Okay. I'm going to stop there. I'd like to answer questions if you have any. If not, I think that's a good place to stop. Any questions? Yes, sir.
It's about the prayers. Does it have to be vocal? Can you do them in your head?
Mm-hmm. Silent prayer.
Silent prayer works?
For me, it does.
All right.
Both, yeah.
Hi, Derek. Kim Adding. I really found something that you said really profound, and that really helped me. It was when you said that you had gone down and sponsored all these guys at the Salmiak, and some of them had bottoms that were like way past yours. At some point, because I do that, I go like, why can't you be as committed? Why? What's blocking you from doing this? And I think that was really profound when you said at some point you stopped doing that, and instead you turned it into thank God that that's not me. I really like that, and I really appreciate that you said that, because that's something I've struggled with quite often. I'm like, man, you know, don't you see you're gonna die? Come on, what's happening, right? And it's so hard.
I know. Thank you, Kim. One, then two.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I really liked your visual metaphor that explained the whole workshop today. Is that God's will is the ocean, and my will
is the wave.
Is the wave. Yes. And that, you know, I do photography, darkness and light are part of the same realm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, we could go. Go on with that one, you know. And so it was an absolutely fantastic workshop, and I'm really, really grateful I attended. Thank you.
Thank you. Charles?
So, Charles Haddock. I just wanted to say, Tarek, thank you so much. I so appreciate how clear you are in your communication. You know, my takeaway point this morning is in the time of devotion, you know, we, in our prayers, in my prayers, I tend to focus a lot on, you know, what I hope to have happen, please make it happen. In other words, I guess the gifts, you know what I mean? The gifts more than the giver. And I think that just that devotional time of just sitting, you know, with God, being in God's presence, and ultimately, when we ask ourselves, why am I here? You know, what is the chief purpose of my life? I think that's it. It's knowing God. It's, you know, knowing God's creatures, knowing God's creation, but it all comes down to loving and knowing and being connected to God. And that's a great way that you expressed it. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Charles.
Hi, Nadia. Thanks, for this workshop. I have a question. You touched on the nightly review, right? At the beginning, when I worked with my first sponsor, I was sending it to her, but it was more, I was writing it to more to thinking of what she's going to think of me. So it's the truth. Yeah. And with my second sponsor, when I kind of had a chat with her, I said, like, I don't want to send you, the book doesn't tell me to send you my nightly review every night, right? But if there's something that comes up, you know, I mean, I talk to you immediately. So, and sometimes I don't know what to do with this, my sponsors, because they don't do it. And I'm guilty of not doing it sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I ask them to send it to me for them to commit more than for them to share with me. Do you know what I mean? For me to share with me. And sometimes I'm a bit confused about what to do with this because there's different theories.
Mm-hmm.
But the book doesn't tell me to do that.
No. Most individuals, when they come into early recovery, if not all of them, they're going to take on the identity of their sponsors. A lot of people don't have an ego when they get here, believe it or not. We've always been told that addicts and alcoholics have enormous egos, but I've seen people that need an ego. They have no self-identity. Their self-esteem is so non-existent. And so there are parts of me, even though I came in with a massive ego, there were dark, broken parts of me, and I began to take on the identity of my sponsor to fill it. And it was the first time people had patted me on the back, and it was because I was emulating. And so because we do have this this idea that this person saved our life, and so we begin to follow the dictates of that higher power, right? And we do exactly what our sponsors want us to do without questioning it. And I don't want to say anything that's against what you need to talk to your sponsor. I'm not the type of, like, when guys come to me and say, my sponsor says this, I say, you need to go to your sponsor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But if something inside of you is questioning that, have a conversation, because I'll tell you this. I won't come down on a sponsee of mine and say, you have to do it this way. That's not the kind of sponsor I am. That means they're trying to control, and I'd be controlling and managing their lives, and that's not what I want to do. I don't give all sponsees the same assignments either. I don't take guys through the steps the same way. It's just, this is part of where prayer and meditation comes in, like actually praying to do what's best for this person as opposed to what's, you know, adhering to this specific formula for doing it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other questions? I want to do one more thing. I just remembered this too. I stumbled across this about 4 years ago, and this is what I've implemented into these two steps. And there are 8 things that I think are of extreme importance, and they all dovetail into these two steps. The first of which is cultivating this what I call remembrance. Now, in the spiritual experience appendix of the Big Book, it says that most of us believe that the essence of a spiritual experience is simply the awareness of a power greater than ourselves. That, to me, translates into I need to think about my higher power as often as possible. And what that translates into is the remembrance. And so I do this exercise of conscious breathing. As often as I can throughout the course of the day, I am trying to acknowledge God in my breath. And for me, that says, I say to myself, there is no God but God. There is no God but God. And I try to do this as often as I can throughout the course of the day. It's conscious breathing. It's remembrance, remembering our divinity. All right. The second thing is contemplation. So you can't be part of a 12-step program, which is spiritual in nature, not religious, and not contemplate spiritual matters. Like, this is a spiritual matter you're contemplating. You're struggling with whether or not you should follow the dictates of the sponsor and do it this specific way, or maybe start to use some prayer and meditation to determine whether or not you're going to do it. But contemplating and thinking about that's important, the connection to God. And so this is an important part of it here. Contemplation, and then there's this self-examination. Okay. Our steps are full of self-examination. Step 1 is nothing but self-examination. Steps 4, 5, and 6, self-examination. Step 10, self-examination. So we constantly have to reflect. You know, I've got a guy who was very important to me and was a massive spiritual figure in my life. Started doing some things I didn't agree with. And the first thing that came to my mind was on the way he was treating people, and he was not going back to make any amends. I realized he had no self-examination in his life. He was not examining his interactions at all. And eventually, you just now, you know, we're not in each other's lives anymore. But self-examination, I have to reflect on how I'm interacting with people. And that can be part of your evening review. It's important. We took my stepdaughter to the Buddhist monastery to take meditation classes, right? They had the classes for the kids. And she came home with this sheet at the end of the, like, after she'd been there a week or two, they gave her an exercise she had to do every night. And I looked at it, and it was like our evening review questions.
Oh.
Yeah, for a little kid. It was, they called it the reflection exercises. And, I mean, it's self-examination is a very important part of this. And then when you examine, this is the fourth thing, is there's a reckoning. So the reckoning happens when you see it and you actually implement a course of action. You don't move into the stage of acceptance. You move into the stage of unacceptance. And you say to yourself, you know what? This is not acceptable. I need to do something new. And I'm going to have Nefisha and Allison and Nicole. I'm going to tell them what I'm going to do. And then I'm going to ask them to hold me accountable for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's a true reckoning. Mm-hmm. Right? You've recognized it and you give it the recognition it deserves. And then you actually implement a course of action. You know, the fifth thing that I value is bonding. We're getting the bonding this weekend, aren't we?
Yeah, sure.
You know, and an event like this opens people up. They're more vulnerable than they typically would be. So there's an element of bonding. See, what happens, though, is the feeling you have created for yourself that's created for us in this event is going to dissipate by Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday. So what are you going to do then? And so you have to have a degree of this in your local communities where you sit around and you talk about God with people and excitement and what I can do, what more can I do. And that's what the bonding, that's where that happens. And then there's guidance. You need teachers. You need more than one teacher. I don't use the word sponsor very often. I like teacher, I like mentor, and I've had more than one sponsor. I probably have more than one sponsor right now. I've got one guy, if you ask me who my sponsor was, I'm going to tell you he's my sponsor, but I defer. I'm guided by several men, and that's the guidance piece of it. And then there's a seventh thing called protection. I protect this beyond all else. I lost a marriage behind this, okay, because I wanted to protect this. And it was really important for me to protect my spiritual path, my recovery. You know, everyone, if I start smoking crack again, everybody else ultimately gets to make up a decision, make their mind up and say, I'm done with you. I'm walking away. See, I can't say I'm done with me. Mm-hmm. I'm the one that has to live with what happens and what I do when I start smoking crack. And I'm just not willing to do that. Right? So I protect it. I protect it. And the last one is inviting ecstasy into your life. We're doing it this weekend. And I don't mean ecstasy, you know, where your minds go with that. But inviting the sublime into your life. And if you devote some significant energy to investigating spirituality in these steps 10 and 11, you will find something very sublime at the root of it all. And it doesn't have to be dogma. It doesn't have to be boring. It can be very exciting. But it demands curiosity. Do you have the curiosity to go outside whatever tradition you're in and see what else is out there? So that's what I did. And then I found something really special that underlying all of it, there's a connectivity to all of it. You have to respect all traditions. That's the thing for me, is I have respect for all of them. I think they're all beautiful. They all have truth to them. They just do. I really appreciate all of you coming this morning. I enjoyed it. If you have any questions, you don't want to say them in a public setting, you can come talk to me afterwards. But thank you.
Thank you. Love the grace of the team. It's the fluidity, right?
I appreciate it.
Was fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. You know, there's so much that when I came in.